Three, two,
one more time.
Welcome to Hungry Magazine Culinary Podcasting. All of our podcasts can be found at www.hungrymag.com. This week we sat down with Ben Roche, the pastry chef at Moto Restaurant in Chicago's Fulton Market Meatpacking District. Chef Roche is working on the cutting edge of cuisine, employing liquid nitrogen, lasers, and alginate powders to develop desserts like frozen Coca-Cola bubbles and hot ice cream. We started out talking about Madrid Fusion, an annual food conference held in Spain, where the Moto crew unveiled their current use of lasers in the kitchen.
That was a lot of fun. It's kind of a gathering of mainly Spanish chefs, but this year I think they did something different. They wanted to do kind of Spain versus America, mm-hmm. not in a sense of, you know, who's better or who's doing, you know, the cooler food, but just, you know, kind of a common, like, bring everyone together and kind of show off what, you know, what everyone's doing, compare ideas.
Yeah, so the New York Times header, I think, was, it's if Eric Clapton went down to Mississippi to teach Robert Johnson to play the flute. I was like, that's pretty apt. I thought that was pretty good.
Yeah, I think they were really receptive to our demo. We brought with us a DVD, mm-hmm. Pretty much what we had on the menu for that night. And we just went through course by course, explained, you know, how we do everything, you know, what's the point of this course. We also had some bonus material at the end of the DVD.
Oh, yeah? Were there Easter eggs?
yeah, exactly. It was a laser demo and some nitrogen stuff. So that was fun.
Cool. So did you pick up anything while you guys were out there? Any new things?
We ended
were
up
pretty
being
much the teachers?
A little bit. It kind of felt like that because we ended up being in Spain for about 3 days, and a lot of that was travel time. So it was more of like an in-and-out thing. Versus going there and being able to see each presentation. We just really had time to set up our own stuff, do the demo, and then head out.
Cool.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. You got to meet a lot of the chefs that were, you know, slated for doing a presentation, and they were all really nice, welcoming.
Do you guys get to visit the Adrias and talk to
them? You know, Ferran was there. I didn't see Albert.
Okay.
He's been in here before, so I've gotten to meet him before. He's a really cool guy. But I've never met Ferran before, and he's pretty intense. He's got a very distinct personality where he's always thinking of, you know, something else. You know, even if you're talking to him, you can kind of tell he's you know, saying something, like just thinking about something crazy he's going to do. He's a cool guy.
You know, I've been doing some reading about you guys, and you know, I know you kind of march to the beat of your own drummer, and you know, I've heard Chef Omar talk about, you know, you don't like to read cookbooks because, mm-hmm. you know, in some ways that leads to copying and things like that, which I completely understand. But I guess, you know, since we're talking about Albert, I'm wondering, are there people that you look to or that you look to for inspiration as a pastry chef, you know? It seems like, you know, pastry chefs kind of get the short shrift sometimes in terms of features, you know?
Yeah,
but there's so many good ones out there, you know?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. As far as you know, other pastry chefs I look to and respect, there's a ton. As far as influences, I try and look actually outside of the whole, you know, restaurant world. I find that I'm put in a more creative position. I'm put in a more creative position, or I think a little bit more open-mindedly when I look to, you know, music or just, you know, other forms of art.
Sure.
And kind of allow myself to be influenced by that versus, you know, looking at a book or, you know, trying to take something that I've done before at another restaurant and then, you know, redo it or, you know, just apply new flavors or something. I think it's a totally different creative process that we do here. One that tries to bring in, you know, other industries to, you know, create a new kitchen, a better kitchen, a more efficient, more functional, faster kitchen. Mm-hmm. And I think we're doing a pretty good job of doing that. I mean, the lasers is a good example of that. Mm-hmm. Like, the reason we brought it in was because it was, you know, this technology that no one has ever really tried to use in a restaurant. Mm-hmm. We just thought it'd be cool to have, but once we got it, we're finding all these different things that you can do with it. Right now, you can actually see it. It's up in the bar.
Oh, okay.
I can give you a quick demo a little bit later.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
But we're actually doing it right now with a wine pairing. So we'll take a glass of wine. Like, we always invite the guests up to the bar, and they can watch it happening. We'll take a vanilla bean and, like, blast the vanilla with the laser, and these fumes just like instantly come up, and they fill the wine glass that we hold over the top of it. And it kind of coats the inside of the glass, leaves like a thin film of that like smoky vanilla fragrance, so that it takes it back to the table, it pours the wine, and the flavor of the wine is totally different, but it's, you know, for the better. Like it goes better with the course that we serve it with, and it's just really cool to watch.
What kind of wine are you using with the vanilla scent?
Do you know which one that is?
I believe right now we have a Chateau Berry. It's a Pauillac.
Okay, yeah.
And we're also trying to expand our bar menu, expanding it by shrinking down the amount of drinks that we're serving. So we have like 5 drinks now.
Okay.
But they're pretty interesting drinks.
Yeah, I know that's one of them he was talking about. You guys, what kind of things are you doing? What are the 5 that you're focusing on right now?
We have one. I can't really go into exactly how we make it, but basically you get an empty glass, or virtually an empty glass with a syringe. The syringe is like kind of a clear liquid inside, and you inject the syringe into the glass, and it just like foams up, like to the very top of the glass. Sometimes it even goes over, but it's just like this, you know, volcano erupting in your cup, and the foam starts to separate a little bit, and the liquid that's left in the bottom is fizzy. It's like a soda, and then the top layer is kind of a rich, thick foam, and that's kind of a variation on a lemon drop. So it's tastes like a lemon drop.
Okay.
But it looks like, you know, something from Mars.
How did the laser come about?
The laser, we actually got it from an online purveyor, I guess you call him. if you can call him a purveyor.
The new purveyors of scientific equipment now in the food industry.
But we'd called him before, and we got this thing called an ion ray gun. And it shoots out a beam of negatively charged particles. So that if you were to take, or something that we did, you know, a ways back, was we'd take a pile of salt on a plate, and then we'd serve that with, like, a beef dish, and we'd put the beef, you know, strategically, like, right next to the salt on the table, and then the server would come out with the ray gun and blast the salt for a few seconds, and then the salt would just kind of, like, jump onto the beef. It's really cool. It's attracted to, you know, to positively charged ions or
particles. It's similar
to,
like, the paint process in automobiles. Yeah. They use the negatively charged paint.
Yeah, so like the whole thing just kind of shifts over this way. It was a real trip to watch. I mean, I've never seen anything like that. It was pretty cool. And then, of course, there's the practical jokes that come with all this new equipment, like, you know, coming up behind someone and blasting their leg, and all of a sudden their pants just, like, suck to their skin.
You guys doing that in the kitchen, or?
Not anymore. We've kind of phased out the ray gun because we really couldn't find any more to do with it than, you know, make things shoot up into the air, and it was cool for a while, but we had to move on. But we went back to the same guy that made it for us, and he makes all kinds of stuff. He makes like microwave cannons that shoot, you know, microwaves, and then he had a selection of different lasers, you know, from anywhere from like the really the weak like laser pointers, where it's just basically light, up to this class 4 laser that we have, and this thing's pretty powerful. I think the temperature of the beam when it comes out is around like 2,500 degrees. So it's really, really hot, and it's really focused and intense. It's this, you know, small beam of light. That's why we can do the vanilla thing. If you do it with a torch, we tried it before, like burning with a torch or a flame, and it goes slower through the whole incineration process, so that by the time you start getting smoke, it's not very vanilla-esque. It's more of like a grill, you know. So the flavor or the aroma that you get from going directly from a solid into this, you know, gas state is much better than, you know, if you go through that kind of middle area where it's more like cinder.
Right. So this is sort of like sublimation or something, right?
Oh, I guess so, yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
Well, it's interesting that you say you phased that out. I think one of the things I've been thinking about is you guys have been doing a lot of stuff, and, you know, you're a fairly new restaurant, but now you've been around for a little while. And I would guess any... You know, I know there's no question that you guys are always testing limits every day, but I would guess also part of the growth or the maturity of being a restaurant that's been open for over a year now, or, you know, you guys rein some things in and you figure out what works and what doesn't work. And, you know, I'm just curious about that process, like kind of things that you guys have decided didn't work, or, you know, it was just time to put away, and why you guys did that. Or maybe you guys aren't, but I don't know, you know, but...
There's not a lot that that hasn't worked that we just kind of shunned and pushed off to the side to forget about. There's been a lot of things that started off with very humble beginnings, like the carbonation. We're doing some pretty cool things with carbonation right now, but it's more than just like soda.
Mm-hmm.
Like when I first started working here, which is about 3 months after they opened, there was two or three different types of soda that were on the menu. Some pretty unique flavors, like they had wasabi and, you know, squid ink and all these other different types of soda. But
and I guess you're getting the orange with the lobster, I think. Some kind of soda.
Yeah, that was a different type of soda. Because what we found is that you can put solid food product inside of these chambers.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as there's, you know, like a moisture content or a water content of whatever you put in there, it'll take on that CO2 and become fizzy. So we started doing that with whole grapes and oysters. So it's kind of a take on champagne and oysters.
Yeah.
So we'd serve, you know, some of the classic garnish stuff like creme fraiche and caviar, things like that. And then you get this like fizzy oyster and a cluster of these small champagne grapes that are like foaming. And that one, we've kind of evolved it, but we definitely held on to that. I think the one you're talking about was the freshly squeezed orange soda. So we just take like orange halves, put them in the chamber for a few hours, and then when they come up to the table, the guest squeezes the orange juice onto the lobster, but it's, you know, fizzy. It's like pouring a Fanta over your lobster.
Which is cool.
Yeah, it's very, very tasty.
Yeah.
I have to say.
So you said you take some of your inspiration from art and movies. Is there a particular mm-hmm. discipline or particular movies or that you like, that you know, maybe there's a dish you could walk me through or something where you said, you know what, you were at an art museum and you looked at it and you're like, oh yeah, you know, I don't know if there's something.
Well, particularly, I'm really into Salvador Dali.
Oh, sure.
More his way of thinking and his way of, you know, creating paintings.
Mm-hmm.
He had a lot of kind of, like, he would invent kind of new ways of trying to project, you know, what's in his head onto the canvas.
Sure.
Like, one thing I remember reading about was he would sit down in front of the canvas and he'd have, I think it was like a tin bucket or like a metal bucket next to him,
mm-hmm.
with you know, like a metal tip paintbrush in his hand, and he would start to fall asleep in the chair, and like as soon as he just went out of it and his paintbrush hit, you know, he'd hear the noise from the metal hitting the metal, he'd wake up and then he'd just paint like the very first thought that he had in his head.
Sure.
So I mean, it's more things like that I can take from him and trying to apply that to my own way of thinking than it is, you know, looking at, you know, a painting of his and saying, oh, that makes me want to cook this.
Sure.
So a lot of the stuff is more of a thought process.
So like stream of consciousness in some way.
Exactly, yeah. Trying to think of something in a different way. You know, being able to look at, you know, a glass full of, you know, fruit or a glass full of you know, plants or something and trying to make a dish out of that, you know, just taking ideas from everywhere but where you normally get culinary ideas from.
I know you spent some time at Trotters mm-hmm. Before this, and then you were at Tilney Hall in England, and my guess is those places in contrast are pretty staid in terms of, or a conservative way of cooking, and my guess is you didn't do a lot of this kind of cooking at those places. Were you experimenting at night, you know, when you were at home? Like after, I mean, you probably didn't have a lot of time working
right, yeah.
in those places.
It's hard to find time to research and develop at home.
Or was this something when you came here, the environment kind of pushed you in that direction and you just started going at that point?
Yeah, before I came to Moto, the other restaurants that I'd been at, they were definitely kind of rooted in, you know, the old philosophies of, you know, fresh ingredients and, you know, classic techniques, but maybe new flavors. And that's still kind of a part of what we do now. You know, we still kind of loosely follow the same guidelines as far as, you know, using a great product, you know, not buying a cheaper vegetable to create something that's
like a globe, one of your puree globes or
yeah,
something.
I mean, you still have to really get the best that you can, but I didn't start experimenting with anything different until I came to Moto.
Mm-hmm.
And then once I got here, at that point it was just kind of a, you know, like a new world pretty much. I'd never really seen anything like it, you know, I wasn't familiar with what Ferran was doing or with what Heston Blumenthal was doing. I definitely heard the names before, but I was really unfamiliar with their food.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it was, I think it benefited me because I didn't have any of these, you know, preconceived notions of, you know, I know how to make a foam or I know how to make, you know, carbonated jellies.
Mm-hmm.
Like I never even thought of that before. So being able to learn from zero and kind of develop my own protocol for, you know, developing you know, a new dish or, you know, trying to imagine a new dish or, you know, thinking of new techniques, it's much easier if you start from, you know, from nothing than
sure.
if you, you know, build on a base that someone else has given you.
Yeah, you ignore constraints because you don't know about them.
Yeah, and I think that's Omar's whole idea about not reading cookbooks. He's not saying that you can't go out and read, you know, Michel Bra, because,
mm-hmm.
you know, let's face it, it's a great book and there's some stunning photography.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he doesn't want the cooks here to rely on sources like that for inspiration for a new dish,
mm-hmm.
Which I can understand. I mean, that, just like I said, that's how I felt when I started working here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you start from zero and you kind of create your own mentality about what, you know, what kind of food you want to create.
So I've been hearing a lot about these, like, I don't know, I guess Tuesday meetings where you guys just kind of come up, I guess the Yuzu sphere that you guys did came out of one of those Tuesday meetings or
sort of.
Well, so how walk me through something like that. What's the typical process for you guys? You know, I would guess it's just a safe place where you can say whatever you guys want and then
yeah.
find a way to make it happen. But
well, generally we'll come in earlier on a Tuesday, usually around 10 a.m. And then as soon as everyone gets here, everyone gets changed up. We'll meet in the private dining room. It's, you know, a large room that we have. We do parties of like 20 or more. So we'll all get together in there. Omar kind of goes around the room, you know, starting with the first guy, and he says, you know, what would you have to eat this weekend? And he'll say, okay, I went to Taco Burrito Palace number 2, and I had some awesome enchiladas. And, you know, like he'll kind of quickly try and formulate a dish out of that. And most of the stuff that we talk about are just kind of like, you know, quick ideas, you know, things to kind of spark an interest, you know, get everyone else thinking about what they're going to do that day. But we've had a lot of cool ideas come out of that. The sphere that you were talking about, that was actually on a field trip that we took. We did a staff field trip to Praxair.
Mm-hmm.
It's a company that supplies us with the liquid nitrogen.
Mm-hmm.
So they were giving us the rundown about, you know, how it works, how they make it, other gases that they have. They were talking about CO2 for a while, dry ice. You know, they have this maker, this dry ice maker. It, like, shoots out this snow of dry ice. And then me and Omar were talking about it after we left. And for some reason, it just kind of clicked at that point that, you know, if we put it in a balloon, you know, put a liquid in a balloon, fill it with nitrogen gas, it's not going to contract when you freeze it in the nitrogen. So, you know, let's try it when we get back to work. And it ended up being really cool. And then you end up with this this hollow sphere, like this perfectly round sphere of ice that's hollow in the center. And then from there, I mean, you can go a step further and, like, fill it up with whatever you want. I think the next level of that dish is to do a pinata course, where we have like a frozen sphere, not a sphere, but a frozen shell of a donkey,
mm-hmm.
and then we fill it up with, you know, like candied donkeys or something.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they get it on the guest gets it on a plate and they break it open and there's all the stuff inside of it.
Very cool.
Yeah. So that's probably the next phase of that one. And that's how a lot of the dishes go. They'll start off as one thing. It might be a new technique for us. It might be something that. That we've done before, but it just kind of evolves into, we don't even know what. Like we just kind of constantly try and, you know, mess with all of our techniques to try and create something different out of it. Another good example is the sodium alginate balls. I'm sure you've seen them before, where you take a liquid, you puree in like an alginate powder, and then you can put that into a calcium chloride bath, and it forms like a skin around the outside.
Mm-hmm.
Using the liquid nitrogen, we found that we can make a completely different puree, freeze it, and then dip it into the alginate so that it freezes around there. So you're still making that skin, but the liquid that's inside of it is completely different. So you can do it, you know, one liquid inside of another. You can do, you know, three liquids inside of another liquid that's inside of two other liquids. I mean, it kind of goes on from there.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun trying to find out, you know, what the limits are and what you can do with it.
I heard you're doing something with Coca-Cola bubbles or something like that.
Yeah.
Or that's the concept. I don't know.
Well, that started off as being it was a component for another dish.
Uh-huh.
It's pretty standard, like foam, like a gelatin-based foam. But instead of charging it with N2O like you normally would, we were charging it with carbon dioxide, so that the foam that came out was carbonated.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be fizzy. So I poured some Coke in there and make like a Coke foam.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically like this giant head that you normally get on a you know, glass of Coke.
Mm-hmm.
And from there.
Is that consistency much different than what you would get if you were?
You know, it's a little bit thicker.
Yeah.
It's more stable.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't dissipate so quickly. But we kind of took that idea, and then we did like carbonated pellets of Coca-Cola, like frozen pellets of Coke that were like fizzy when you ate them, and then also some.
So like the. Like the Kentucky Fried ice cream and those kind of things that you're
doing?
Yeah.
You know, very Dippin' Dot esque,
mm-hmm.
but different flavors, different kind of textures in the mouth. And also we did one of those alginate balls that was clear, and on the inside was like some of that colorless Coke. You know, the stuff that you, like it's clear, but it tastes like Coke. And it's
right, like
carbonated.
The Crystal Pepsi.
Yeah, exactly. Something like that. And then we put more alginate balls, like smaller ones, of the brown Coke inside of that. So it was like Coke floating inside of Coke that were, you know, bubbles inside of a bubble. And we just kind of put all this together, and it's like, you know, six different ways to make Coca-Cola bubbles.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty interesting.
How's people, have you served that?
Yeah, we did the whole dish for a short time. We didn't feel it was substantial enough to be on the 10-course menu.
Mm-hmm.
So we did a smaller form of that on the big menu.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, people thought it was really cool and people were psyched. You know, I think probably the most difficult thing for us to pull off with these different techniques is getting people to relate to it and to be able to deal with, you know, what they're eating.
Sure.
So we found that the easiest way to get over that is familiar flavors. So, you know, Coca-Cola, everyone knows what it tastes like. You know, you taste the foam, you taste the bubble, and it's like people get it.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing another one now with peanut butter and jelly, which has been done, you know, 1,000 times by everybody. But this one's pretty cool. It's a similar technique where we take a frozen peanut puree,
mm-hmm.
basically the peanut butter, and then we'll coat it with the grape alginate,
okay.
and then we'll throw it in the bath so the grape turns into jelly.
Yeah, I saw
around
the pictures
the
of it. I was wondering what was inside because
okay.
I couldn't tell. So that it's a peanut.
It's
puree.
Like peanut butter, yeah, basically. And then we take French toast, like a standard kind of bread pudding, and then we cook it sous vide. So it's like this kind of melt away texture,
mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the bread component. And then we also have like a bread praline.
Mm-hmm.
You know, instead of like a nut praline, just make it with, you know, dehydrated bread. And yeah, I mean the flavors are there. It looks nothing like peanut butter and jelly, but it definitely tastes like it, and everyone
so
loves that.
I want to play devil's advocate a little bit,
mm-hmm.
in the sense of, you know, so one of the things I think I've been thinking about is, you know, with something like peanut butter and jelly, you know, I think the things I've heard about the philosophy of what you're doing at Moto is how food or the way we serve food is relatively undeveloped compared to like other branches of science. You know,
mm-hmm.
we haven't evolved as much, and so you guys are kind of trying to push that. And, you know, but at the same time, I mean, I think one argument would be like the peanut butter and jelly sandwich,
mm-hmm.
in its regular manifestation of, you know, piece of bread and jelly, and you know, some people will use a good organic bread and they'll use a, you know, a great freshly made jam and things like that to make it the best. But some would argue that evolution at that point is the best incarnation of it.
Okay.
You know, I don't know that that's true, but you know, but maybe it is. And you know, are you really offering a superior idea, or are you offering just something that's different but maybe a lesser version of it? I don't know. You know, is it a, you know, I think you know, like Jelly Bellies, you know, it's like this, you can get a butter popcorn jelly bean, but given the choice between the two, I'd probably, in the end, want a piece of buttered popcorn.
Yeah.
You know, I know you guys do the styrofoam or packing peanut, you know, but I think in the end, given a choice, somebody would rather have, you know, and so where does that line, what's that line for you guys, or is it matter? Doesn't matter, I don't know, you know?
Well, it definitely does matter, but I think the goal of the restaurant is for people to come in more for the experience than for, or I shouldn't even say that. It's more about the experience, the overall experience, you know, the multi-sensory, multifaceted, you know, culinary slash theatrical experience that they come in for when they come to Moto.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily trying to take, you know, a dish that can't be topped, you know, a dish that you really can't improve on and improve it. It's more of taking that dish that everyone can relate to,
mm-hmm.
that everyone thinks is, you know, untoppable, and just giving it to you in a completely different form, almost unrecognizable, but having it taste just as good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just kind of very thought-provoking food, something that people can think about for the next few days, not to make them want to try and make this at home. You know, every time they want to eat a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, they have to go through this, you know, 4-hour process
right.
to get set up.
Right.
Yeah, just more about presenting these things in a completely unfamiliar manner, and enjoying it. You know,
mm-hmm.
being able to think about it. You know, stimulated more mentally than if you're just going to get a bite to eat.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely more than just coming in to eat. It's I think anyone that comes in here knows that they're in for, you know, a 2 or 3 hour experience versus, you know, just a filling meal.
Sure.
So, I mean, we're not just trying to have a restaurant that can produce this unnecessarily wild food, but we definitely want to bring in some new concepts and just kind of, you know, get people's attention and say, you know, this is interesting. This is more interesting than I've ever seen it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can relate to the flavors. It tastes great, but yeah, I've never seen anything like this before.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually one diner that came in. He's a student at Columbia, and he came in about a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago. And he went for the GTM menu, which is about 20 courses. And about halfway through, he realized that he didn't know what he was getting into, but he was thoroughly blown away.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been back a number of times. He actually works with us now. He does a lot of artistic stuff. Anytime we need to do a filmed DVD presentation, he'll come in. You know, he'll film a DVD. He'll edit that out. He's the restaurant's biggest fan, and you know, he's just one of the few people that have really had almost a life changing experience just from, you know, seeing these kind of sensorial aspects of eating in a completely different way.
Yeah, I guess in some ways it doesn't even have to further cuisine, or it doesn't. I mean, I'm sure it does, but in some ways, you might inspire somebody the same way Dolly would inspire you to cook. You know, you might inspire somebody to write a book or do something differently because of what they ate here.
And
so there's some value to that experience. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, this what we're doing right now, what other restaurants are doing that is even similar. This may not be, you know, the food of the future, or, you know, it may not be around for the next 50 years, but I definitely think it's going to spark enough interest to get people thinking about this and to change what they're doing, you know, toward the future, or, you know, to look to the future to say, let's change it a little bit. We don't have to go completely crazy and just, you know, try and, you know, puree everything and make it taste like something else. But it's kind of like, I think the food movement right now is a lot like the like surrealist kind of period, you know, back in the late 20s, early 30s, when people were doing this just because they wanted to, because that's kind of the way they thought. It wasn't really widely accepted, kind of like
mm-hmm.
what we're doing now.
Or even Nouvelle Cuisine, probably
yeah.
30
yeah, yeah.
years ago.
Yeah, I mean, this is like the punk rock of food right now.
Sure.
And a lot of people appreciate it. Some people really get it, and other people hate it.
Mm-hmm.
But
so, I mean, obviously conventions don't seem to apply much here. But
we try and leave them at the door.
You clearly have a ton of free time as a chef, I'm sure. what do you do when you're not cooking? What do you do to kind of decompress? And
you know, on the weekends, I normally get together with some of the chefs that work here, and we'll try and just go out to restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, try new places to eat. Like one common thing that I've found in most of the chefs that I've met is that you know, eating just makes them happy. Like for me, nothing really makes me happier than eating.
Sure.
So to do that with, you know, different people on our time off is probably the most enjoyable way to spend your time. Besides that, I do a lot of reading.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much focused on like food or science or anything like that, but just, you know, general novels. Like a lot of I like a lot of Japanese authors.
Who are you reading? Murakami, maybe, or
Yukio Mishima.
Okay.
He was this. He was an author back in like the, I guess it was the 60s,
okay.
40s, 30s, or 40s, 50s, and 60s. Wrote a lot of novels in Japan that were really good. There's also another guy, Kobo Abe.
Mm-hmm.
He has very much a kind of surrealist, like I guess avant-garde approach to writing a novel. It's kind of like half mystery, half suspense.
You know, there was I was doing some research before I came over. One of the things I saw, I think on one of the food blogs, somebody was talking about they had tasted something that you were developing, which was a dark chocolate custard with Maytag blue cheese and Peruvian ground cherries.
Mm-hmm.
Have you guys served that? I'm curious. That sounds great to me. I know not to everybody, but is that
we didn't do exactly that.
Mm-hmm.
But we did something with the custard. We made. Like basically, we make the flourless cake and then puree it with gelatin,
mm-hmm.
and then whip it in a KitchenAid so it kind of inflated, and then we would like put that into a small mold and press like a frozen, basically an ice cube into the center of it. So then, as the cake set, the inside would melt, and that was our chilled liquid center chocolate cake,
mm-hmm.
That we did with hot ice cream,
mm-hmm.
and people seemed to like that one too. We actually developed the hot ice cream in a pinch. I guess Albert Adria was in town. He was doing something with the French pastry school. And he called up our reservationist and said that he wanted to come in because he'd heard that we were doing hot ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, we'd been doing a form of hot ice cream where it was like basically a warm liquid in a pipette.
Mm-hmm.
And so we thought, okay, that's not going to work. Like that's not enough for this guy.
Sure.
We know what he wants, and we got to give it to him. So I was down there all day, like trying to, you know, invent something that's hot ice cream, and so we found like a number of different ingredients that you can basically make a puree, like a solid puree out of, freeze it, you know, make a shape like a canal or, you know, like a round scoop or whatever, and then it'll hold up to like 170 degrees without moving, and then it's got like a creamy kind of consistency of ice cream.
Oh, you know, what's your last meal?
Last meal.
Chef?
Definitely some form of donut.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Would it be the donut soup? Or would it actually
maybe
be the Krispy Kreme?
Maybe with the donut soup. You know what? I'd probably have to go with Krispy Kreme glazed donuts, and then Dunkin' Donuts Boston cream.
Yeah.
Maybe a selection. But I think that would kind of send me into the next world.
Not
you know what? It'd either be donuts or it'd be the enchilada supreme dinner from Taco Burrito Palace number 2.
Mm.
I really can't decide between the two of them.
That seems to be a favorite of the restaurant, the Taco.
Oh, God.
Number 2.
Yeah. You can't go wrong.
Yeah.
We've nicknamed that place the Deuce, and you absolutely cannot go wrong with the Deuce.
Yeah. Are there other places around town like that that are kind of informal that you really love and you go back to a lot? Or?
Yeah, actually, right next door to Taco Burrito Palace number 2 is Noodles in the Pot.
Okay.
I don't really associate them with, like, fine cuisine, but, I mean, it's very simple. It's, you know, the food is pretty good, but it's a nice place to go just with, you know, a few different people and talk about whatever you want to talk about. It's great in the summer because they have an outside area. You can just sit back and drink Thai iced tea.
Nice.
Yeah.
You know, eventually down the road, I know maybe it's not next year or the year after, but what are some next steps for you? Do you have, like, an idea of where you want to go? It sounded like you alluded to someday maybe your own restaurant or whatever it is.
I think if I ever had any kind of, like, food establishment that was my own, I'd probably prefer to do just bread, you know, just like a few different types of bread, and that's it. I've always loved bread baking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the whole procedure where you start off with these raw ingredients and you kind of create this living thing essentially, and then you make, you know, this incredible bread out of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the most satisfying aspect of cooking for me.
Has Wiley DeFresne been in here?
He has. He came in, it was a few months ago, maybe 6 months ago. And I guess he had a really good time.
Yeah, he said, good feedback.
Yeah, he said he was really pleased.
It'd be interesting. I was thinking it'd be cool to have like an Iron Chef. I know you guys did that and you can't talk about it, but you versus DeFresne.
that would be interesting.
It would be interesting.
Definitely. We could have the ingredient be like tapioca, melted dextrin, or, you know, some random ingredient that no one knows what it is.
Awesome. That's all I got. I appreciate you doing this.
Cool, yeah. It's my pleasure.
This ends this culinary podcast for Hungry Magazine. Check out www.hungrymag.com for more.
Three, two.